This is Business of Home. I'm your host, Dennis Scully. Every week, I'll be talking with leaders and innovators from all corners of the home industry. My guest this week is Jonathan Miller, President and CEO of Miller Samuel, a real estate appraisal and consulting firm he co-founded in 1986. The data and research that Jonathan and his firm compile on real estate markets around the country inform the decisions of some of the biggest real estate agencies in the industry. And no one is more widely quoted on the subject of housing prices than Jonathan. I spoke with him about what rapidly rising interest rates will mean for the housing market, why sellers are slower than you'd think to lower their asking price, and why those Zestimates you see on Zillow might not be telling you what your home is really worth. Hello, listeners. Dennis Scully here. I'm excited to announce that Business of Home's Future of Home Conference is back, taking place in New York City this fall, September 12th and 13th. Future of Home will be 2 days of future-focused exhibitions, small group workshops, networking opportunities, and riveting discussions with leaders of the industry. I'll be your host, alongside my colleagues Caitlin Peterson and Fred Nikolaus. And I promise, it's going to be great fun. Get your tickets now at futureofhome.com. And of course, a huge shout out to our sponsors, High Point Market, Benjamin Moore, Brizo, The Tile Shop, Afterpay, and EQ3. I can't wait to see you there. This podcast is also sponsored by Serena and Lily. With a dedicated trade team and design shops from coast to coast, Serena and Lily's exclusive trade program has the personalized service, products, and custom details you need to execute your vision seamlessly. From trade-only discounts to complimentary swatches, COM to custom by the inch, being a Serena and Lily trade member offers endless inspiration, giving you and your clients the unique look you deserve. Join their trade program by visiting serenaandlily.com/trade. And now, on with the show. So recently in the New York Times, you were quoted as saying, we are in this cauldron of uncertainty, right?
Right.
And who can remember a time where things have felt less stable than they do right now in your market?
Right. There's so much stimulus or input coming into all consumers. You know, they've just lived through a global pandemic and had plenty of time to sort of sit and stew, and mortgage rates are dropping, and they jumped out as soon as they could, and we saw this frenzy. And I cover about 40 different housing markets across the U.S. for Douglas Elliman Real Estate, and it's all the same. It's the same condition where you had this frenzy, and now you don't. Because that's what happens when you basically double mortgage rates.
Precisely. So let's set the table a little bit for listeners, picking up on what you just said, which is all of a sudden we have seen a near doubling in mortgage rates just since the beginning of the year. So in an unbelievably short period of time, rates went from, let's call it, below 3% to they almost touched 6% for a time. They're now at sort of 5.75%, roughly, let's call it. And explain for listeners what that does in terms of how it affects affordability, in terms of how it affects how people think about even moving forward with right. the decision to buy or sell.
So the Fed is trying to damage the economy, literally damage the economy by pushing rates higher. And they're trying to make homes less affordable. They're trying to create more unemployment, all to slow down the economy, which became overheated, you know, coming out of the lockdown. And so what has happened is that mortgage rates, by spiking, have made housing cost much more for the same property than it did earlier in the year or the end of last year. And the way to think of it is, think of your housing payment as like a donut, just because I love donuts. And then you only have that donut that you can pay every month. And what happens is, so all of a sudden that principal and interest payment got a lot bigger. You can no longer afford that donut, that house. And the problem with that is, so immediately sales activity slows. And when sales activity slows, inventory rises immediately. And that's been one of the narratives in the pandemic era about housing is supply was obliterated because, in my view, interest rates are too low for too long. So now we're in this condition where everybody's expecting, you know, because if inventory's up, that means prices go down. And that's not what happens. That can take a year or two because the sellers that aren't going to get their price don't sell. That's because the seller, unless they have to sell, doesn't. So the market really slows down. But at the same time, we're not looking at a sort of bubble bursting sort of scenario that we had during the financial crisis because lending has been very conservative.
Right. So banks have been much more disciplined in their lending.
They never lost their minds in this frenzy
the
like
way
they
did
during the financial crisis, right? So we don't. So that means we don't have a banking crisis like on the other side of this.
Yeah, but interestingly, to pick up on what you were saying about the Federal Reserve and specifically the Federal Open Market Committee that sets interest rates, your feeling is, and you're not alone in feeling this, that the Federal Reserve kept interest rates artificially low for too long.
Yes.
And that in housing, you were seeing signs of excessive movement and price spikes and all of the other things that went along with mortgage rates just being far too low, right?
Right. And the sign of that before anything was that bidding wars nationwide were roughly half of the transactions. That is not sustainable. That is not normal.
Well, and explain for listeners what that means when you say bidding war is.
So bidding war, our proxy for a bidding war, the way we measure it is we look at houses that closed for a price higher than the last asking price by the seller. You know, buyers generally don't volunteer to pay more for their house unless they're forced to. And it was rampant. In Southern California, we had markets that were 80, 100% bidding war late last year, early this year. That is not a healthy market condition, and it's not sustainable. And the one thing that has come out of this for me, and it makes sort of people's brains crack when I say it, is that low mortgage rates in this cycle have made housing less affordable. Because what they've done, what that's done is obliterated supply because there's such an imbalance. Inventory is like this, think of this as organic being that is based on the life cycles of the occupants. And the occupants need time to, you know, become empty nesters, to trade up, to move to a different location because they get a promotion or whatever. And that all takes a certain period of time. And so what you have here is housing supply being obliterated by the insatiable demand that exceptionally low rates sort of created. And now we're in the decompression stage where, you know, rates are more where they should have been. You know, just the warning sign of the frenzy of bidding wars nationally should have caused some alarm, I would have thought.
Well, and why do you think it didn't? As learned a man as Jay Powell is, why do you think they were reluctant to raise rates a year ago when all of these signs of excesses in the stock market, in the housing market, were there in plain sight?
They're not looking at the right housing data. I mean, there's been a long history of, you know, during the, before the bubble, the great financial crisis, the Fed was relying on housing data from the National Association of Realtors, who is a trade group, right? It's always a good time to sell. That was their source. And then they pivoted to Case Shiller, Robert Shiller, the Nobel laureate. And that's academia. And the Case Shiller Index still comes out every month, but it has very little to do with the housing market because it lags conditions by 5 to 7 months. So it'd be like, you know, us waking up this morning and checking the average temperature in January, and that's what we wear today. And it wouldn't be very useful. And now we have CoreLogic and other sort of data sources that they're relying on, but there's still a lag in that data anyway. And so the on-the-ground sentiment is what I think they need more of. And there was a lot of it, but it didn't seem to register.
So we're already seeing that coming off of the recent inflation data that we received, that the market has begun to price into the market a series of rate increases by the Federal Reserve. Right. And so now they're calling, right, they're calling for at least three more, it seems like at this point, three more 75 basis points or 75 one-hundredths of a point, right? Yeah, rate increases. What's that going to mean, do you think? What's the impact of that likely to be?
Well, again, this listener shouldn't think of me as a Fed economist. I pride myself in being a non-economist, I guess is the title. But it's clear that there's going to be more rate increases. And actually, I was pleased that if you're going to raise rates a lot, better to shock and do with the make it front end loaded so you get it over with sooner than just dragging it out and having less sort of connection with consumers. The thing is what happens every time they've done a rate increase, mortgage rates spike, and then they drift down quite a bit. And then just as the consumer's starting to get their arms around the higher rate, there's another rate increase. So, and my gut reaction to all this has been, initially was this is going to be just like 2018, maybe for different reasons. But in 2018, towards the end of the year, they were saying at least three more rate hikes in 2019. And they ended up being a bunch of decreases because they had gone a little bit too far. And the problem with going too far is you create a recession. And the problem with the recession is you create a lot of unemployment, and housing doesn't do well with tight credit and unemployment. So it's definitely a concern. There's not a lot of confidence one way or the other, whether this is going to be a hard landing, a soft landing, how far this goes.
So our listeners are this combination of interior designers and furniture companies and fabric brands, all of these companies and all of these people who are working in and around the home space in every way that you can imagine. And so nothing is more important to them and their livelihood than getting a handle on what is really going on with housing, particularly in the slightly higher end housing market than we might normally refer to.
Sure.
So earlier when we were talking about affordability and some of those issues, a lot of the people that are hiring interior designers, this isn't their first home, or they're not first time home buyers.
Sure.
So what we've seen in this market in the last few years that feels at least new to us, and you tell me, you've been at it much longer, there seem to be all of these cash buyers that showed up that dramatically inflated prices, and there appeared to be this ever-growing number of institutional buyers. Blackstone suddenly buying the house next door instead of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So tell me about how that has affected the market.
One of the biggest changes that we saw right after the pandemic lockdowns ended was an unleashing of demand in the upper half of the market, call it, because lower wage earners were severely punished economically with the lockdown and all the layoffs that occurred and companies going under. And so you had this awakening of demand. And all of a sudden, there was an instant pivot because people weren't selling their homes in the cities and moving to the suburbs. It was renters were sort of leading it. But the upper half of the suburban markets boomed and essentially obliterated, again, my favorite word with inventory, obliterated inventory for the high end of the market. And so the question now is, what happens next? Is the higher end more vulnerable, that section of the economy more vulnerable than lower wage earners. And I would say they are less vulnerable because the lower you go in price point in housing, the more dependent you are on financing, on getting a mortgage. Hmm. Doesn't mean people that buy higher end properties don't look at mortgage rates or aren't thinking about or having impact on their affordability, but the probability is lower that lower in terms of restraining transactions. The other thing with cash buyers are tend to skew higher in the sort of price strata for primary use for someone buying a house versus maybe an investor, which is heavily cash and might not be a high end. It's they're looking at properties they can rent. But what's been quite amazing is, you know, there's this sort of logic that, hey, you know, the higher end, like this is always talked about in New York, like higher end, they pay all cash. So they don't care about interest rates. But that's absolutely not true. So the way to look at it is Fed policy impacted the spike in mortgage rates. Well, Fed policy is also impacting the volatility of the financial markets. The financial markets tend to be what more affluent, you know, sort of a playground for the more affluent, you know, rather than sort of the typical consumer. And so it is creating volatility and, you know, nervousness that comes with that, which is sort of a headwind for the higher end of the market, but certainly not as significant as the challenge of mortgage rates doubling.
We're taking a quick break from the show to remind listeners about Serena and Lily. Known for their unique coastal-inspired mix, Serena and Lily makes good design their business, working with trade professionals like you to transform interiors. Join their trade program to enjoy exclusive trade discounts and flat rate delivery, COM and complimentary swatches, and services tailored to your specific needs, like extra customization options and extended returns. You can even use their design shops as an extension of your workspace. Become a trade member at serenaandlily.com/trade. And now, back to the show. We talked earlier, you mentioned that often one of the risks or the challenges for, let's say, the Federal Reserve is looking perhaps at the wrong data or looking at lagging data. It is often confusing when talking about the housing market. There are pending home sales. There are new home sales. This morning, we got this very low number for the builder sentiment number, which is apparently the lowest it's been in 37 years, with the exception of March of the COVID crisis, right? But so, right. All of these numbers, and listen, regardless of what number you're looking at, for the past few months, they've all been going down, some more dramatically than others. But what is really important in your business, which is appraisals, which is really telling people what their home is truly worth or likely to sell for, what numbers are meaningful to you? What should people be looking at?
Well, I think there's, and this sounds really odd, but I think there's an overemphasis on price trends. Hmm. And what I mean by that is not that they're not important, not useful, but if you're trying to gauge right now, the pricing reflects what happened at some point in the past, right? And then it eventually closed and that was it. And also contracts, you know, which are, you know, pending home sales, right, or they're called contracts or new signed contracts. The problem with contracts is they don't all close. So, like, do you look at contracts? Do you look at closed? You have sort of the timing issue. And then you have prices and you have inventory. Those are like prices, sales, and inventory are really the sort of the basic metrics. And if you had to pick those, you'd want to pick, you know, probably contracts and listings at the same time because they show closer to the meeting of the minds moment. But every data point has their flaw. Do you look at average sale price or median sale price? If you look at average sale price and you have a $250 million house close in your neighborhood, it really skews everything. In a median, it doesn't. But in median price, if the market's starting to drop, usually the first thing to drop is the lower end. So when what happens is the median actually rises when a market starts to go turn weaker, because the lower end sales activity drops out first and it moves the middle of the market, the median, upward. So even though median is sort of the official metric of real estate, or unofficial, whatever, it's the one that's usually most cited because it removes the outliers, but it still has its challenges. So the sort of the tricky answer to your question is, the number one thing to look before you do anything is always, always, always look at the source, where it comes from.
So sure, you hear that suddenly 14% of the contracts didn't close. That does sound alarming, right? That does make one step back and say, oh, clearly something has changed here. People are walking away from the deal. They're walking away from the handshake. That sounds like a concern. What are meaningful signs? Again, going back to this higher end housing market, what are meaningful signs that there is a significant change? We've seen rumblings at the lower end, as we've talked about, right? And unfortunately, the first time home buyer is much more impacted by the rise in mortgage rates. But what is going to affect that higher end housing market, and what should we be looking for as the warning signs?
Well, to me, the leading indicator is always contract activity. Think of it as numbers are in the front of the train and prices are in the back of the train, even though, you know, there's no cabooses on trains anymore, but let's just live in the past for a minute. And so everything that's the transactional part is in the front. So that's going to be, you know, closed sales, which lag, contracts, which don't necessarily close. You've got those in the front along with listing inventory. But there's thousands of things to look at. To make it simple, it's really just transactions and price. And then within transactions, you have days on market, which is another, you know, how many days from when the property came on the market to when it went to contract is a days on market. But the problem with that number is you're only looking at the successful ones. You know, that I'm making this up, but, you know, this one market might be a 50-day marketing time or days on market. That's for all the houses that closed in the second quarter in this market, right? That's doesn't capture the unsuccessful ones. My favorite metric, and it's not always available, but I think it's the best metric out there for trend, is called months of supply. It's the pace of the market, how the market feels. So essentially, the formula is basically inventory divided by sales for the month of supply. And the reason why that's so helpful is because supply and demand is the driver of housing value, housing price. So you have inventory, you know, in the numerator, and sales in the denominator. And that tells you the number of months that it would take to sell all the inventory at the current rate of sales activity. It's sort of like turnover in a grocery store, like, you know, they turn the bread over every 3 days, or, you know, it's like that. And I remember in the run-up to the great financial crisis, the housing bubble, we had, like in Manhattan, we had, the market was blistering, but inventory was at record highs, but because there were no underwriting restrictions, sales were even higher. And so when you put them together, it sort of showed a more realistic pace than if, because what happened was when the market stalled, sales collapsed and inventory now is all by itself. If you were just looking at inventory, it tells you, you know, during the boom period, you know, which was like a couple of years, there was all this activity, but you were looking at supply and demand with months of supply. If you were just looking at inventory, you probably would have been warned. You could see it coming, but it wasn't really telling you about the behavior of the current market. It was telling you the behavior of the future, which is there's a ton of stuff here that is going to have to be sold, and there aren't any sales to support that.
There was a number that suggested that apartment sales in Manhattan fell by 30% in June. Is that real? Is that a meaningful number? Is that... Or is that just, oh, those contracts just didn't close?
Right, right. So it is real.
Okay.
So co-ops and condos, which are literally 98% of the residential market in Manhattan. And yes, they both fell. Now, they've been falling every month since beginning in April. So the June number wasn't like brand new, like hit us in the face. But there's a saying in journalism, like three data points make a trend, and then the trend is your friend. So April, May, June all showed this diminishing behavior. Now you see that, and you know in the spring, that's the boom. That's the Super Bowl, the World Cup.
Right. Well, that's why it was so surprising, was that it came in the spring.
But what was interesting is inventory had been chronically low for the last year and a half. And then all of a sudden you have this period where sales are falling, so inventory is rising, right? You know, they're sort of inverse relationship, more sales, less supply. And that's what's happening. So when you see inventory rising and sales falling, that tells you that sometime over the next year, it could be sooner, it could be later, that you're seeing softening in prices. That's the way it goes. The one thing I always, for sellers that in the market that are, you know, like, I'm going to get my price or I'm not selling, like, the market doesn't care what you think. It just does what it does. And I've always found that amazing because, you know, it's so emotional. So I would look at, like, with your listeners, I would expect, it's already happening, sales activity is cooling nationwide, but prices aren't falling. And so you don't want to look at prices if you're trying to figure out transaction activity, you know, how the market, you know, is it robust? Is it not? You know, it's certainly not what it was.
But it doesn't sound as if you feel we're about to go over a cliff.
Absolutely not. Like,
okay.
I've been asked the question a lot, like whether we're in a bubble.
Right.
And my context for bubble is what happened during the financial crisis, where there was no logic and the pricing was built on nothing. It literally was nothing, no due diligence, no underwriting. And that is not the case now. So there's a firm underpinning underneath is the way I've been describing it, underneath housing prices, where I'll give an example, like my hometown, normally there's about 200 listings. And then a year later, after the lockdown, there were 50. So you go, wow, inventory really fell. And then inventory the next year, early this year, was 12. So it went from 200 to 12. Now with the rate increase, inventory has spiked. It's tripled. So now it's like 40. So it's like 75, 80% below the norm. So even if it doubled or tripled even more and more and more, it's going to be a while just to get to break even. And that sort of keeps a firmer underpinning on top of not having a surge in foreclosures because mortgage underwriting has been so diligent compared to the non-existent underwriting during the housing bubble.
The ninja loans of the housing crisis.
Right. I call them, it wasn't a housing bubble, it was a credit bubble with housing as a symptom. And we don't have anything like that in this cycle. I'm not, you know, I always hate people that say this time it's different, but this time it's different. It doesn't mean that there won't be some, you know, markets where prices go down. It's just, I think the context is compared to 08, it's not a cliff, like you said. It's, you know, it's an adjustment. And some segments will do better than others.
Right. And you cover a lot of different markets, and we've seen explosive growth in parts of Texas and many parts of Florida, and a lot of places where New Yorkers and others fled during COVID and discovered there's quite a lot to like about those places, right? It turns out they're very warm, turns out taxes are low, and
right.
And the country really changed its scope and shape and form, and a lot of these places sound as if they've acquired permanent rather than temporary.
Yes, the remote phenomenon, you know, Zoom became ubiquitous in 24 hours after the lockdown.
Yeah.
Nationwide, it was instantly obvious what could be done with it. And so it's changed everything. But what's a little bit different in this cycle is it doesn't feel temporary. It feels like a restructuring of the housing market. One of the things that I, when I think of Zoom or remote work, it's almost as if the tether between work and home became infinitely longer, is the way I've described it. So that it, you know, it wasn't the 1 hour commute. It was, you know, the 2 hour commute, but only once a week, right? So there's lots of people doing the math. And one of the reasons why the higher end, I think, has some legs on it in terms of, you know, with this higher rise in rates is that, you know, generally, I think it's a reasonable statement to say that the higher, more money you make or the more you're worth, the more mobile you are. And so, you know, it's no coincidence that we're seeing you know, a lot of strength in the, you know, the say upper half of the market versus the lower half because of that reason and that mobility and going to new locations like Florida if you're in the Northeast.
Well, and it seems like it's that very point that you just made that seems to be supporting this notion that perhaps even if rates do continue to rise at the very high end, if you don't need to be back in an office at Goldman Sachs in New York, even though he wants you to be, I get it. But the more income you make, as you just said, the greater the likelihood that you can be in Boise, Idaho, when you want to be, and you can move to Florida again in your other house when you want to be. So you have all of this mobility, you have now multiple homes, and perhaps the high-end market remains buttressed and supported by these people that don't need to be in any one particular place anymore for what they do for professional.
I certainly think that's a reasonable way to describe it. In life, there's no guarantees, but you know, from a probability standpoint, you know, if you just be very simplistic and think about the high end, low end, I think the higher end, because it's under less economic stress and has more mobility, that, you know, barring some surprised economic event or something or unforeseen, it seems like there'll be less pain with the higher rates in the upper, you know, the upper end of the market, the housing market.
We're taking a quick break from the show to hear more about the upcoming Future of Home Conference. Here's a clip from last year's event, a conversation with Eric Edelson, the CEO of Fireclay Tile, about why he chose to pursue B Corp certification.
I think for this industry, right, we're so very much product driven. What we're specifying, where it comes from, whatever, like what it looks like, what color it is, what price it is. And I always say, like, B Corp is, it's like in the past, we were very focused on like organic or fair trade, right? Certifying products around certain things. B Corp is like certifying the holistic company behind all of these products. Again, we're talking about the future of home. And I think the future of good is moving from this idea of like certifying products to the companies and the people and the operations behind those products.
This year's event is September 12th and 13th in New York City. To get your ticket, visit futureofhome.com. I'll be hosting, and I can't wait to see you there. The other interesting point that you made earlier was lots of these very large homes. Where I live in Bronxville, there was a wasteland of enormous homes, right? That one thought at the time were never going to sell again. We were told that younger people didn't want those great big homes, right? And they were far too big, and they were all and they were millions of dollars. But then COVID came, and all of those homes sold very nicely.
Sold.
Thank you very much. Yes. What happens next? What happens with all of those great big houses? Does that market come down? I mean, what's your sense there?
Well, I think that at least in the near term, that there's some downside risk for sure. It's not disconnected. Those buyers are not all cash buyers. But also, I think we don't really know. And what I mean by that, this is part of the uncertainty, is how this remote sort of setup between home and work actually ends up after a while, right? I mean, we sort of know that we're not going to work 5 days a week on average, right?
In an office.
So we know that there's a lot of changes. And we also know that the prognosticators about the big old homes that the boomers built, you know, aren't going to be saleable. What happens, at least, you know, where I live in Connecticut, is you just see a tremendous amount of them being torn down and replaced with more modern properties. I think I'm a little surprised at how wrong that forecast was. I wasn't prognosticating that.
Which forecast? The forecast about the big houses would never sell?
Right, that the older houses, that time is over.
Right.
And like no one wants to, everybody wants to live in the city or they want to live somewhere else. You know, so not all futurists know what they're talking about.
The other storyline that people would forever flee the city has turned out not to be true.
Yes.
No greater example of that than rental prices in Manhattan. Even though people aren't returning to the office in a meaningful way in New York City, they are tripping over themselves to rent apartments there. Tell us about that market.
Yeah. So, you know, on one hand, we have heavy new leasing volume. The leasing seasonally peaks in August. So there's still a couple more months of
for prices to go even higher.
More increased demand, right? And then, you know, the rents in Manhattan are the $5,000 a month threshold being reached. And last month, the $4,000 median rent threshold was reached. And at the same time, office towers are 60% empty. So you go, well, how is that possible? Well, first of all, remote work is not a suburban city thing. There are, you know, this is just generalizing, but there are just as many people living on the Upper East Side as Westchester that are remote working, right? I mean, it's not a city suburban thing. It's became a sort of perk and quality of life issue. And so now you're looking at, there was a, speaking of trade groups doing surveys, there was a survey by the, I think it's Partnership for a Better New York, that said that only 8% of office workers are working 5 days a week. And so that sort of tells you. It also, all leasing activity reports about the commercial office world all say things like leasing activity is normalizing. What they don't tell you is that office rents are off 25, 50%. But they're not down a few percentage points. Like, this is a reset in commercial. But yet, purchase demand, sales demand, rental activity, rental prices are high or near records. You know, and this was going into the sort of Fed pivot to higher rates. And now the Fed pivot, you know, trying to raise mortgage rates to slow down the housing market, is actually making rents higher because people that were going to buy, and with mortgage rates doubling, they're tipped into the rental market again, right? They're going to either renew an existing lease instead of buying, or they're going to get a new apartment to rent. And so that's attributing, and that's why I think one of the things I've been saying about the rental market is the opposite of rising rents is not falling rents. It's stabilizing rents. I think that's the next step. Because at some point, we're going to hit an affordability threshold for consumers. But I don't think we're there yet. I think we still have a little ways to go, even beyond the end of the summer.
Well, and as you've often talked about, we've been building the wrong rental properties to address the affordability issue, right? So we've been building the higher end rentals, and perhaps we've overbuilt in that area, it sounds like you feel.
So in the U.S., all the rental development that we've seen over the last, you know, 5-7 years has been skewed towards the upper half of the market. And that makes sense. You have land costs are really high, construction costs are high, and supply chain issues during the pandemic made it incredibly high. Labor costs are much higher. And so a developer can only build what is economically feasible. And you know, if you're going to build, there's a skew towards higher end product because that's what the economics are dictating. Listen, a developer would build affordable housing if there was economic incentive to do it. And local governments don't have the money to properly incentivize it. So it's a real challenge. The part that I find amazing about cities like New York and others is that there's this, after being written off as dead, there's just been this tremendous pivot. And now there's inbound, right? There's inbound activity instead of it all being outbound. Schools have opened, you know, students are coming in to rent. The sort of asset owner that's going to be left holding the bag, so to speak, are commercial office landlords and the retail space, the, you know, retailers below, which need the oxygen from a full office building. So eventually they're going to have, you know, we're going to have to see price cuts in a meaningful way to get those filled.
You mentioned some of the many narratives that people got wrong during COVID, the fleeing the cities, that's all come right back around and they're all coming back to the cities. The big houses would never sell. Turns out that they did sell. We got so many things wrong. We sort of misjudged. What seems to be sticking, as we were saying earlier, is all of these hot markets, Dallas and Boise, and right, those all we thought, oh, that'll just be temporary. That'll just be a flash in the pan. It seems like no, people have permanently relocated in many ways to those, yeah, right, to those areas, and that changes so much of how the country feels and perhaps votes and perhaps,
yep,
decides things going forward, right?
It does, and it can change the political dynamic in a region. You know, we've seen that in the past. One of the things that I think has really driven this has been tax policy. So, you know, the Northeast and California are known for the highest taxes in the country, and therefore they are seeing the most outbound generally, and the inbound is going to the lowest. You know, like the Florida and Texas and, you know, Arizona, like, you know, these markets are, you know, just pulling in people. And I've had a lot of conversations with small to mid-sized towns where they have positions that are just there to attract businesses. And one of the first thing they do is they focus on the C-suite, and because they're the ones that make the decision. And it's proving in Florida, it's proving to be very effective.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of these states are doing a very good job of bringing big corporations down. That's going to bring even more people for the housing market there, as new jobs are created.
When you're in, I go to Dallas a couple times a year, and when you're in Dallas, it feels like half of Dallas are California companies that have moved there in the last like 5 years. It's unreal how much inbound commerce has come into that state.
Well, and is going to stay there. I mean, that's what's most striking about this. These are changes that are here to stay.
Yeah, this doesn't seem a reactive short-term move. This seems more structural, like I was saying with Florida, that the perception has changed. We don't even understand the half of it coming our way over the next 5 years. But the only thing we do know is that there's a lot of change still coming. We haven't quite figured out everything yet.
Well, now, before I let you go, and I'm going to burst the bubble for a lot of our listeners who spend quite a bit of time on a website you know well called Zillow.
Yes.
And the Zestimate has become a big part of our culture. And Jonathan, if I understand you correctly, you don't put a lot of stock in the validity of the Zestimate. Is that right?
I don't. So full disclosure, I was on Trulia's industry advisory board before they had a website until they were basically acquired, although call it merged with Zillow. So I got to sort of see how the sausage was made a little bit. And so I've always marveled at how Zillow has won the consumer from the broker. They have won in that regard. Because they have a lot of disclaimers and methodology pages, everybody thinks it's all covered. But no one actually reads that stuff. So just a quick sort of summary of Zestimates. And I'm in the valuation business. My company, Miller Samuel, is... we're an appraisal company, and so we always marvel at, you know, because we live and breathe value all day, sort of marvel at the way that the numbers work. But if you look at all of the U.S., the median, and this is the key word, it's disclosed on the website, the median accuracy rate of his estimate is 2%. So you go, wow, they're within 2%. That's pretty good. So it's median accuracy. So that means 50% of the time they're within 2%, and 50% of the time they're not. Right? So that's not impressive, really, as something to sort of say how accurate it is. And then it gets worse. It's only accurate within 2% nationally if the property's on for sale. It's on the market. It's a listing.
Right.
If it's not on the market, the median accuracy rate is 7%. So that means that it's 50% of the time it's within 7% and 50% of the time it's not. So they actually need the brokerage community to price to get to drop to sort of shave off 5% in their accuracy rate, which is sort of astounding. And then I learned in selling my house recently that the Zestimate was way below what we asked. And it had been for the 20 years I lived in this house. And, you know, I could be biased. It's my house, right? It's hard to be objective. And then I put my house on the market. And the Zestimate the next day was equal to my list price. And then I cut the price just a few percent. And the Zestimate went down to what I cut the price because I wanted to sell quickly. Mm-hmm. And we did. We actually got an offer above the last ask. And magically, the Zestimate, you know, is just stuck right at what our list price is. And then when it closes, it'll probably go up a tad. And that's what happened to the house we bought. Same thing. Because they've, after being publicly criticized for their lack of accuracy, and they were sued in Chicago, but won, I'm guessing they changed their algorithm to highly weight the listing price to get them in the realm of reasonableness, which is weird. So, you know, it's just one of those things, if you don't read it carefully, there's a false security in how useful or accurate it is. Don't get me wrong, I certainly look at Zestimates. Like, you know, when we were looking for a house, we definitely looked at Zestimates, but as a first look, not as a, you know, we don't know this neighborhood kind of look, but didn't base any decisions on it.
But more important to you, I'm assuming, would be other recent transactions of,
yeah,
right?
That's exactly right. Right. Recent transactions, a house that we bid on that we lost. Based on the sales, we knew we were overpaying a little bit, but the market had literally, you know, right after the first year, it just sort of accelerated. That wouldn't be shown in the raw housing data. You could just feel it on the ground. It's an odd thing.
So, and having been in the appraisal business since 1986,
right,
was it a relief to you to discover you're not going to be replaced by robots anytime soon, Jonathan, that it turns out humans?
I don't think so. I mean, there's certainly a thing called automated valuation, AVMs, which is what a Zestimate is. Mm. And really, they should be used for probability. Like, what are the odds that this is over this price or under this price? As opposed to what I've actually told one of the founders of Zillow in person when he came to visit me. If you look at a Zestimate, it's down to the dollar. Mm. So it implies a precision that does not exist. And, you know, why don't you change that? Well, you know, that sort of thing.
Zillow in general is fascinating. And as you say, they won over the consumer.
They did.
Right. And it is staggering. I was just reading a book about trying to get some of your own time back, and the author even referred to, come on, you know how many hours you're spending on Zillow. It's just become part of the culture, as if it's a sport like activity where you're just looking at housing prices.
Just before the pandemic, I was taking an Amtrak to Washington from New York, and the people across the aisle from me were having this excited conversation about, you know, that they literally were checking the Zestimate of their house every day. And it kind of like people do the stock market, right? Right? How's your portfolio?
Yeah.
It's like, what are you doing? You know, like that's not how to, it's a long-term asset. It's not a stock. Anyway, I found that amazing.
Well, it's fascinating to see. And it's fascinating to see how much real estate has become such a part of the culture, and it is a spectator sport for so many, and people dine out on it, and that used to just I used to just think of that as a New York City thing.
Right, right. It seems to be everywhere. When I first came to New York or started doing this in New York, I just assumed that the whole country was doing it, and it wasn't. But I'd say in the last 10, 15 years, it's really pivoted in that direction for sure.
Yeah, there is definitely a national obsession with real estate. And what an interesting time it's going to be in the next 6 to 12 months. You don't seem terribly worried, if I read you correctly.
No. No, I'm not terribly worried. But I, you know, there's going to be weakness for sure. There's a little bit of pain. I'm not so sure how long it lasts. Who knows? You know, one end of the spectrum is, you know, it's going to be a depression forever, black hole, we're all going to die. And then the other end is, you know, there's nothing to this at all. So once again, coming in the middle of the range is probably healthier.
So you think there's going to be a little bit of pain in some areas, but on the high end, you wouldn't be too worried.
I think proportionally compared to the balance of the market, that there'll be less impact. But there will be impact.
Well, it's a somewhat positive message for you to leave us on.
It's the best I can do.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, my pleasure too. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest design industry news, visit us online at businessofhome.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, browse job listings, and join our BOH Insider community for access to online workshops, a free print subscription, and much more. If you have a note for the podcast, drop us a line at podcast@businessofhome.com. If you're enjoying these conversations, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps others to discover the show. This show was produced by Fred Nicolaus and edited by Michael Castaneda. I'm Dennis Scully. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.